Thank you very much. So just briefly to introduce this afternoon, guys, we have two talks this afternoon. We've got Anne critiquing Matt Kavanagh's Against Equality of Opportunity, and then we've got Alan on thoughts on the role of the modern state. We're then going to have a coffee break and then another Q&A. If I see anybody falling asleep, I will force us all to do exercises.
So, turn the
I am the ultimate hypocrite, so please do not fall asleep. Thank you. Anne.
To begin, a couple of explanations. One, how do I come to be speaking here at all? And two, how do I come to be speaking under a heading which is slightly other than you've got on your leaflet? Back in January, Steve emailed me. He said he needed more speakers for today. And he offered seven possible topics. And since it was one which was labelled Principles of Distribution and Equality, brackets, e.g. Marxism, Kavanagh, close brackets, I thought that seemed to have my name on it. So I agreed to that slot and to the Kavanagh title. But then the booking leaflet appeared, and I saw that this afternoon's session was billed as being on the theme of the state and intervention. And that enabled me to focus a bit more directly on what I actually wanted to do, which is why you've got your leaflet, which is not a handout for the talk, before the talk. My talk is now better thought of as an investigation of this notion of intervention. So to anybody who came particularly to Kavanagh, I don't imagine there are many of you because most people haven't heard him. Let me say just three things. One, the handout which you have tells you something about him and his book, and I'll be very happy to answer questions from that. Two, because his arguments exemplify what I think are the problems with this concept of intervention, I will be referring to him across my talk as his background. And then three, at the end of my talk, I'll be returning to him in a bit more detail, him as he talks about equality. As you will have seen from your handout, he talks about meritocracy, equality, and discrimination. And I'm going to settle on the middle one. So first of all, to this notion of intervention. I think there's a problem in our very brief, if you like, for today's discussions. And it's a problem with the juxtaposition of individual and state. Individual and society debates, individual vis-à-vis society debates, are generic to all the social sciences. And state and civil society debates are specific, particularly perhaps to the economic and political sciences. But what this state-individual thing is doing is that it's crossing, and I think maybe confusingly crossing, what I might call recognisable levels of discourse or something like that. So I'm going to begin with a bit of concept realignment, if you like. The initial problem for all the social sciences is how to see the relationship between the individual and society. And having done that, and only having done that, the consequential problem, as I say, mainly for the political and economic sciences, is that of how to see the relationship between the individual and the state, where the state is not society, but it's that which claims to act on behalf of society, which is something different. Now, what this means, I think, is that a talk about the consequential individual-state relationship is only possible via talk first of the individual-society relationship. And so that's where I'm going to start, and I'm going to do so by drawing attention to what I think is a fatal flaw in the way in which that initial relationship, individual-society relationship, is routinely seen. And the fatal flaw is this. In none of its anyway mainstream formulations is any foundational validity granted to society. Now, what I mean by that is such validity as society has is derivative. Societies are made by individuals, derived from their needs as individuals. And I think that's just wrong. Nothing is only a thing in itself, separate in identity. Everything is also a thing in relation to other things, connected in relationship. And identity and relationship are both interdefinitional and co-originate. Think of those people living in Hobbes' State of Nature, who've already featured, living their lives solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. What I'm challenging is the solitary bit. It's not just that only huddled and mutually interdependent people could have survived back there in the state of nature, wherever it was, imaginary or otherwise. It's not just that. It's that only huddled and mutually interdependent people, could have emerged in the first place. All those creation stories with an Adam character in them are doubly daft. You cannot conceive of them theoretically, but you cannot conceive of them just literally. What you've got in those sorts of situations is that as soon as there's more than one individual, i.e. from the beginning, there is also society, that is, relationship. And because it was the only circumstance in which the individual, or rather those individuals, could have existed, they were already back there in their state of nature. They were already living in society. So, if a foundational validity is to be granted to the individual vis-a-vis society, and that is mainstream in almost all the ways in which this problem is posed, a foundational validity has also to be granted to society vis-a-vis the individual, a foundational validity. Which means that as far as the language of intervention is concerned, we have to recognise a mutuality. It's not just that in the beginning, foundationally, individuals fashion society. It's also that in the beginning, foundationally, society fashioned individuals. Society is neither outside nor over against the individual. The individual is neither outside nor over against society. If it helps, which maybe it doesn't in their way. If it helps, think of it this way. It's not that there's a relationship between the individual, one thing, and society, another thing. It's that the relationship between the individual, one thing, and the other individual, another thing, actually is society. That's what society is. So society is there right at the beginning. If you like, one individual, inconceivable. Two individuals, one relationship. Three individuals, three relationships. Four individuals, six relationships. Five individuals, 10 relationships. Six individuals, whatever. 15 relationships. So you go up Pascal's triangle. And the reason why society is more than the sum of the individuals is because it is actually the sum of the relationship between individuals. And there actually are more of them, many, many, many more. So what does this mean then? That's the background to the society thing. What does this mean when you shift to the individual state relationship? It means that if the state is that institution which acts on behalf of society, and I'll return to that if in due course, then the same argument applies. And yet, once again, in none of the intervention models also of that relationship is there any foundational validity granted to the state. Spectacularly not in Matt Kavanagh's book, for example. Any validity which it is deemed to possess is also thought of as non-foundational, derivative. So in the beginning there are individuals, they abandon their solitariness, come together to form society, in the process agree to surrender some of their freedom to a state of some kind, and hence it has some derivative validity. So why is that a problem? It's a problem because it generates the same sort of asymmetry as emerged in the individual society case. And what both asymmetries do is to allow the following confusion to arise. If we ask, to what extent should the state intervene in the activities of individuals? The liberal democratic answer tends to be as little as possible. It's certainly Matt Kavanagh's answer. But if we ask the question, the equally valid question, to what extent should the activities of individuals intervene in the state? The same liberal democratic answer tends to be, what do you mean? In Matt Kavanagh's case, it's not even that, it's just silence. So now, using a very simple example, it's over simple, let me try to explain what I mean. Property rights were critical to the foundation of the state, and they remain critical to the current operation of the state. So my simple example concerns the concept mine. Excuse me. To intervene is to come between, and one of the most significant ways in which people think of state intervention is of its coming between me and my money. For many, the tax man, if not public enemy number one, is at least somebody who needs, as far as possible, to be thwarted in his efforts, preferably legally. But in extremis, well, who knows, the money is actually mine. Now, both the classical social contract theorists, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, particularly Locke, but all of them, and the classical economists, I would think of Adam Smith, Ricardo, and Marx, when they were talking about the origins of private property, that is, of mine, they tended towards various versions of the following. This is oversimple because their versions were all different. That when the very first producers mixed their labour with virgin soil, the resulting product became legitimately theirs. My labour, mixed with that which is as yet the product of nobody else's labour, that is, it's natural, it belongs to nobody, becomes legitimately mine. So bring this up to date. Hostility to the redistributive role of the state through the use of taxes to provide public goods and services is commonplace. Why should I give up some of my money to public provision, especially to those who might benefit without contributing themselves? But I want to point out something vital, which is routinely missed, I think, in such formulations. I want to ask, just how much of what I earn is really mine? Now, if not unearned income, although some people even include that, but if not unearned income, then at least earned income or transfer payments are thought of by almost everybody as legitimately theirs. But the Belgian economist and philosopher Philippe Van Parijs, Kavanagh, he also has a doctorate in philosophy from this university, but he also has a doctorate of economics from his own university in Louvain, and I think it shows the difference. He draws us up short. He argues that in earning my X pounds for working my Y hours, I have to realise that it's X minus rather a lot, which is actually mine, which is what I've earned solely with my labour, as opposed to with my own labour, as it is mixed with all the past labour of all my kind. He points out that part of what looks like the product of a person's labour, and thus income, simply consists of the value of those scarce resources which that person has to appropriate in order to produce at all. We fail to realise, he says, that much of the income that goes to labour in fact derives from our common inheritance of resources. If you like, does anybody here think that tomorrow when they go to work, perhaps most of you don't go to work, look at the audience, you're going to be mixing your labour with virgin soil? There is a very, very important sense in which every product and more important for the case I want to make, every commodity is actually a social product, a public commodity, which means that there's a very important sense in which it's individual private appropriation, not social public origin, which is what needs explanation. And there's more. Even when we've peeled away from mine, all that's really only my access to our common heritage of resources, and reach that albeit small portion, which is unquestionably mine, produced by my labour, there's more. For this labour, this capacity to work and earn, which is mine, has also been totally and completely socially produced. Immediately by my upbringers and my educators, and less immediately by, again, all my kind. When we break for tea in a minute, come on a minute, whenever we break for tea, and there's a tea leaf floating in the top of your cup, which you never know, it might be, register that this small piece of your sustenance, and thus your capacity to work and earn, has been part of a leaf picked by someone, probably a woman, whom you will never know, and it's been socially transported to your teacup by a complex social infrastructure by thousands of others you will never know either. Now, in case it's not obvious, perhaps I should make something clear here. The law recognises three basic entities: res, actiones, personae, things, actions, and persons. And because I wanted it simple, I spelled out the story of mine in terms of those personae who are individual persons. But of course, it's the appropriation achieved by corporate personae, nations and their armies, companies and their contracts, which really matter to this case. And particularly the appropriation, initially by what Marx called primitive accumulation, of those magical goods which are the means of producing other goods, amassed over centuries, achieved by means rarely above question, defended by laws of inheritance made by those who would inherit. It was this vast appropriation of the public by the private which produces the economic system in which we operate today. A system in which that war of all against all, which Hobbes was putting back in a state of nature, you could say is actually here around us. Now, for my money, an economic system which, via relentless and sometimes ruthless competition, offers as its sole incentive to have as mine more than the next person has as theirs, is truly a sordid, sad, soul-destroying thing. So returning now to that individualist bewilderment before the equally valid question, to what extent should the activities of individuals intervene in the state? This is what I mean. I mean that individual private ownership of the means of production, individual private appropriation of the goods and services thereby produced, and the turning of those goods and services into commodities. Commodities are things that exchange at a price on a market, with the aim of making individual profit, is surely just such intervention, isn't it? It's the intervention of individuals and groups of individuals in society as a whole, as represented by the state. It's just Nozick's, what's he called? Capitalist acts amongst consenting adults, he calls them. Be they private individuals or private corporations, are just as much intervening in the state, aren't they, as the state, when it tries to regulate them, is intervening in them. I need you to think about that and return just for a minute to the more usual, if I think much less accurate way of seeing things, that is to the state and its interventions. State only. It's certainly a contradictory creature, this state. Fundamentally, it's a two-faced creature. We've already had this quote, a part of what I want to quote now, emerge, a quote from Hegel, though the translation that I've got appears to be different from the one which came out earlier. In his book, Lectures on the Philosophy of History, this is 1837, Hegel saw one of the faces of the state, one of these two-faced creatures. He saw it this way, he said, all the worth which the human being possesses, all spiritual reality, he possesses only through this state. For truth is the unity of the universal and subjective will, and the universal is to be found in the state, in its laws, in its universal and rational arrangement. The state is the divine idea on the earth. That's one face. The other face of the state, Anatole France had a go at in a book of his which is called The Red Lily, which came out in 1894. And this was the other face. He says, the law, in all its majestic equality, forbids rich and poor alike from sleeping under bridges, begging in the street, and stealing their bread. Now, it's a theory. If it's a theory of the state which will accommodate both of these apparent antinomies, the state is both impartial in the rule of law, above the fray of competing interests, in the one hand, or as sourced in accumulated wealth, its laws used to look after the interests of the accumulators. It's a theory which will accommodate both of those things, which is hard to come by. And I think it's especially hard to come by for a philosophy steeped in classical liberal individualism. And I think that's what we heard this morning, classical liberal individualism. It's very hard to come up with a philosophy of the state which will combine both of those antinomies if that's your starting point. First, such a theory would have to recognise the non-derivative validity of society, and therefore of the state, and I've tried to deal with that one. But second, it would have to recognise that the state is not an essentialist category. It changes. It develops. Historically, I would say, looking at Anatole France and Hegel there, that what you've got is a steady shift, by no means complete, from the Anatole France position to the Hegel position. We certainly haven't got there yet. So let me now try and deal with that changing, developing part of the state. En route, as it were, you know, where we are now, the actually existing relationship between society and the state is this one. Society consists in all the people, rulers and ruled. The state consists in some of the people, rulers. And this is the case, however those some are arrived at. To the extent to which it has been achieved, the rule of law, as opposed to the rule of rulers, is undoubtedly a fine achievement. But short of deep democracy, and that's a concept that I'm going to go on and develop just now, that extent is very far indeed from being complete. Start at the level of political principle. Think of deep democracy, a democracy which of course has never existed, as the situation in which it really was the case that government was of the people, all of them, equally, by the people, all of them, equally, for the people, all of them, equally. If you like, the situation where Lincoln's words, those are his words, met Rawls's public reason as the reason of free and equal citizens in a political community. In such a limiting case situation, the distinction between society and the state would disappear. Why? Well, because it's not possible even to conceptualise an all itself intervening in an all themselves. It's only when the state is not one of deep democracy that its intervening stance can be posited at all. So that's at the level of political principle. If we then shift down to the two levels below principle, strategy and tactic, shift down to the level of political strategy, and the question in that situation becomes, well, how can the further democratisation of the state be best encouraged? And if you shift finally down again to the level of political tactic, it becomes, given the currently less than deeply democratic state, which is proposing intervention X, whatever it might be, should it be supported or resisted? And my answers at both of these levels, at the level of strategy and at the level of tactic, bring me back to Kavanagh, because I said I wanted to end with Kavanagh. They bring me back to Kavanagh. The first thing, strategy. If the question is how can the further democratisation of the state be best encouraged, the answer is certainly not by even more further decline into if it moves privatising. The answer is certainly not that, and yes, if you read Kavanagh, you'd think that it was. In his piece on the Jewish question, 1843, Marx suggested that the citizen of a free state, and he was referring to a free capitalist state, as one which had achieved some democracy, that is, he was referring to us, leads a stressful double life. In his real life, in civil society, and for modern as opposed to postmodern political philosophers, civil society just meant market society. He is isolated, at war with everybody else, in defence of his private interests. In his fantasy life, as a citizen of the state, he's integrated into a would-be moral community supposedly looking after the public interests of all. Now, if deep democracy requires the fantasy to become reality, then it's those market relations which need curtailing. Relations which Marx referred to as the callous cash nexus. Relations which Michael Sandel, our current lecturer, was looking at in his first lecture and saying, this needs curtailment. And we can't have lived through the last few months without knowing that. So that's at the level of strategy. The answer, if we're interested in deep democracy, we do not want more privatisation of everything, which is what Cameron is looking for. The second tactics. If the question is, given that a currently less than deeply democratic state is proposing intervention X, should it be supported or resisted, whatever the proposal is, the answer is certainly not. If it produces more equality, oppose it. If it produces less equality, support it. But again, that is the impression left by a dose of Kavanagh. For again, it's deep democracy, which is the aim, and that would be my aim, I don't know how many of you would be joining that. If deep democracy is the aim, then what you need is not less equality, but more. So, to conclude, let me offer a glimmer of hope for this man, for even he has a little chink of doubt about what he's saying. And it's in his middle section on equality. He says, the intelligent egalitarian would argue, quote, there are important respects in which we differ, but that the one respect in which we are equal is so important that our equality in this respect must be expressed in the way we are treated. Now, overlooking for the moment the absurdity of positing respects in which we differ as the opposite of a respect in which we are equal, it's sameness, not equality, which is the opposite of difference. It's inequality, not difference, which is the opposite of equality. But never mind that. He then goes on to argue, if there's no property which all people possess, and to an equal extent, there can be no basis for an argument for equality. So he then runs through various possibilities, and I'm running out of time, so I won't tell you. There are possibilities about do we have equal humanity, equal consciousness, equal rationality, and he answers no in each case. He then looks at the argument from fraternity. We often find ourselves, he says, just wanting to share equally with others who have produced maybe not as much or maybe even nothing. So he says, well, that will work for small intimate groups. It happens in families, but it can't, or not in all families, but it can't happen in whole societies, he says. And he punches that point home by saying, for after all, the standard economic model is one of individual competition, not communal sharing. And since he's ruled out from the very beginning a consideration of anything other than the standard model, well, that's that. However, there is just one candidate possibility which gives him pause. Quote, according to religious egalitarians, there is such a claim. The fact that we are all God's children. He turns this idea around for an inconclusive page or two, not sure it would seem what to do with it. He acknowledges that, quote, it's easy to understand why the supposed fact of being one of God's children is thought to silence other differences. It is, after all, a rather unique kind of consideration. But he eventually concludes that since there is no secular analogue for such a belief, then in an increasingly secular society, it just won't work. And the fact that he's clearly troubled by this one pleases me considerably. I get the powerful impression that he's not as satisfied as he'd like to be with his case against it. And since, also as an atheist, as he is, but of a considerably different stripe, it's just such a secular analogue for God, which in my own book, Making God, I try to construct, I'm delighted to find him so troubled. And there's even greater delight to follow and to finish. For next, he writes, humanity has never been a collective enterprise in any substantial sense. He's talking about the animal whose speciality, language wrought, is cooperation. And follows that with saying, simply saying that we are all God's children emphasizes our similarity in the relationship we each have separately with God. Whereas it seems to me that what an egalitarian needs to do is emphasize the relationship we have with each other. And my already very full cup delightedly runneth just over, for again, it's precisely the relationship which we have with each other which in my own book is the very basis of the secular analogue that I've been trying to construct.
Okay, Alan. Yep. Sorry, Sam. We're not using any projection.
No, I'm not. And there is a hand I will do it. Shout if you can't hear at the back. And try and keep the time. I have always found political philosophy a bit disappointing, and after a brilliant series of expositions this morning, I thought about where I stood and still felt the same overall feeling, but a higher level of disappointment perhaps. But now after Anne, I'm not sure what I feel, because the concept realignment that she offered, I think there are relations, there's a similarity between her diagnosis and mine about this uneasiness with the what she called the classical liberal individualism model of which has been the foundation of political philosophy anyway in the English tradition since the 17th century. But although our diagnosis has a family resemblance, I haven't really been able to take on board her wholesale concept realignment, which seemed to redefine a lot of things in ways which I don't know how to handle. I will try and refer to it, maybe in discussion we'll come back to it, but I have to go through my talk on my own approach, which is to point out, I think, that that traditional classical liberal model, as indeed the title of this whole day's discussion implies, a sort of crude binary relationship between the individual, to put it that way round, and the state, which Steve properly and very clearly described as a coercive institution, law being the mechanism of this coercion of the individual. And this is okay from where it originated in the Civil War, Hobbes and all that, to answer the rather basic questions: why should I obey the state, the state's laws, and when it, the other side of the coin, when is it all right or even obligatory to disobey and rebel? And these are, of course, serious, real questions, as you can see in Iran right this week. But they aren't the only questions, it seems to me, that are interesting about the title I've chosen, the role of the state, and what political philosophy might be expected to help think about in a framework for discussing the practical questions on the role of the state. They do constrain you to this rather narrow view that broadly there are individuals, never mind the state of nature, but they are to be seen as separate units. The Hobbesian solitary adjective has been quoted more than once, and then over against that there is the coercive state, and any action by the state to coerce infringes and diminishes the liberty of the individual. So you have this assumption as a sort of zero-sum game that whatever the state does may benefit some objective security broadly, but it'll certainly equally diminish the liberty of the individuals who are subjected to this. So that's one assumption, zero sum. And even behind that, there is the assumption which I've already implied, that on the whole, liberty is the important thing, as the state is the baddie which is lurking to make things worse for people, and the less of it, the better. And that clearly was the broad view in 17th, 18th century, when Adam Smith, for example, said it was the highest impertinence and presumption of governments to watch over the economy of private people. And this is where we're starting, and it no doubt matched the way people in government, around government, thinking about what they wanted from government, saw it at that time. But it is very crude, as I've said. This binary relationship ignores all the other relationships, and the impossibility of the state of nature, which Anne mentioned. At least there are family social groups right from the start of human existence. But there are also relationships, gift relationships among tribes, charitable relationships, and the one I particularly want to focus on, which is the market relationship, which has been, since very early days, the nexus, the cash nexus, call it what you will, which has controlled the, facilitated the operations of man in his economic activity. And that whole dimension of the market, it seems to me, is left out by the binary model and hardly discussed. There is, of course, as has been referred to from time to time today, the notion that the state has to define property, and it is, of course, true that the market requires a certain clarity of ownership. Where land is completely common, it's impossible to tell who has what and who can rely on what as their crop and so on. And Locke built on that that necessity with this rather implausible theory of adding labour, which has been discussed. But it that aspect of human relationships as we experience them, and they do loom very large in our dealings day to day, much larger than the taxman or any other activity of the state, has not since 17th century figured in anything recognisably. But, well, perhaps not ever. I mean, Marx had views on property and capitalism and the market. But the broad tradition of political philosophy, which I'm most familiar with, I can't claim to have read much Marx, is looking at the crude model, the basic questions, obedience and rights, which don't bring in any of this economic stuff. And that is, isn't it, a familiar feature of how philosophy has evolved from natural philosophy, which looked at everything, science and human society and God and the whole works. But as people specialised and got more empirical and specific, the sciences were detached from natural philosophy, and that was followed in due course by political economy, which became economics. And though it was very much discussed in the 18th century, and Adam Smith was much involved in both, and Hume had things to say about commerce as a sort of aspect of justice, it from then on had become a separate topic. While this was happening in intellectual terms, there were the beginnings of the state itself changing its taking on new responsibilities and a broader role than the minimalist holding the ring role that Locke rather implied. I mentioned Marx it's clear that in the 19th century, because of the increasing concern with the state of poverty post-industrial revolution, the state was being expected to do more about the poor and the sick and the uneducated, and it's a rather strange Hegelian pattern, I think, or appropriate Hegelian pattern, that from the Lockean minimal state, where the assumption was the state would do practically nothing, you swung to Marxist communism, where the thesis was that the state should take over practically everything, and it's only when that communist model appears to have failed. I better be careful as we're discussing with Anne later. Appears so far to have failed that you get a sort of thesis, antithesis, synthesis pattern to the kind of mixed economy that we're stuck with at present without much enthusiasm. But that is where we are, and it's not clear to me that that political philosophy has got very far in appropriately framing discussion on the role of the state in this present phase of political evolution. Put in the handout a quote from my old tutor John Mabbott, a book he wrote, again you see, Binary Model State and Citizen, 1949. I won't read it out, but it broadly says that there are some things which the state may be concerned with, where he could see no unifying principle among these ends, objectives, no system or scheme to which they must belong. In other words, as the welfare state was being set up, it was rather hard to see what you could say about it from a political philosophy point of view within this good old binary framework. And I think we've had some discussion, particularly Rob, this morning on Isaiah Berlin and negative and positive freedoms. It does seem to me that was a move in the direction of acknowledging that the state was not simply infringing people's freedoms which were of a negative kind that would be imperiled by the state, but there were positive freedoms and the Roosevelt Four Freedoms are an obvious source for this, freedom from want in particular, the 19th century poverty I've referred to, where you had to give people a bit more freedom by some more positive action by the state so that they could fulfill themselves more fully in the Isaiah Berlin sense as a positive freedom, which complicates the notion of freedom as an absolute simple concept, which Rob again was questioning this morning. And I think the conclusion that freedom as a kind of clear objective where you know whether you've got it or what would increase it is confusing and not the best way of tackling the analytical problem. So what I'm proposing at the bottom of the first page is that we should see the state in a tripartite model, with that the role of the state is to provide those services which, in the view of society, which I'll come back to, are worth providing, but which would not be provided by the market left to itself. And this is to try to bring in the economic concept of the market as on the same footing as the activities of the state and the individual as the recipient related to both these entities. The concept of the market, I want to discuss those three in turn and see what you think of them and what can be made of them as concepts. I won't realign concepts quite as radically as Anne was doing, but I will try to make them a bit clearer. The market left to itself is an abstraction, well, they all are, but I think it has some meaning. The problem with it, as we've seen all too clearly, is that the market left to itself can collapse rather seriously into chaos. And this is both a point about the rule of law, the contractual framework, which collapsed in post-Soviet Russia and led to a good deal of disruption and maldistribution of resources, and more recently the demonstration that markets left to themselves go to extremes of the kind of herd instinct which requires regulation so that they not all the bankers go bust. But I think there is a point in bringing this concept in, and it's interestingly parallel or echoed in the Dworkin insurance principle, which was being talked about, where from an American lawyer, the idea of people insuring themselves against bad luck, misfortunes of all kinds, appeals strongly. But then he recognises that this won't do if it's just left to itself, and you need a way of covering the risks which doesn't depend on people only buying those risks they are lucky or unlucky enough to find themselves facing. And I think there is therefore a correspondence between what I'm arguing for and that insurance principle that Dworkin was pointing to. But the question in Dworkin is quite clearly if you're to look at what people would have deemed reasonable as an insurance premium if they had not known their particular situation, their particular good or bad fortune, the question is clearly who is to say what would have happened, and how could you reflect that, detect it, and give it effect? Which brings me, I think, to the Vega concept of the view of society, because in effect you are looking for a way collectively to assess this kind of ideal position outlined. And the view of society, Anne again was interesting in talking about society as the sum of relationships among individuals and having a sort of equal reality with the individuals who make up society. And I see what she's arguing at, but the fact is we are all individuals. We know, each of us, what as individuals we're aiming at, and but it's quite hard to see how you detect what society's view is. And this brings us back to the familiar ground of Rousseau and his idea of the general will as what the state should be aiming to implement, and an important distinction, I think, between this idea of the general will, which is what people individually and in discussion argue for as, to use a parallel phrase, in the public interest, and what he distinguished from that, which was the will of all, which is what each person individually wants to see for themselves individually. And although this is a hazy distinction, they'll say the arithmetical sum of all the things that people want for themselves individually may not be the same, it's certainly not the same level of discourse as this, as discussion of the general will, the public interest, what I call the view of society, looking at what is best for the collective, for the nation that is the subject of government activity, state activity. And I think it is important to see the level of discourse. It's why political philosophy is, in a sense, a subset of moral philosophy, that there is, as there's universalizability in moral judgments, see R.M. Hare, there is in political judgments the context of arguing for the public interest rather than just arguing about my income, my party, my constituency, which is a different tone of voice, what I call level of discourse. But having elevated this concept of the general will, made it sound all right as what we're aiming at, and of course there's an argument about whether it exists at all, see Margaret Thatcher, but we can see in a broad kind of way why, for in discussing the role of the state, this is an important criterion. You come down to the awkward question, how do you discover, as I said about Dworkin, how do you discover what it amounts to in practice? And I find a quote from Robert Peel almost two centuries ago, who's talked about the tone of England, of that great compound of folly, weakness, prejudice, wrong feeling, right feeling, obstinacy and newspaper paragraphs, which is called public opinion. And I like this because it was by a politician, a rather intelligent politician, at the time when politics was getting democratic in England, and how he was trying to feel for a way of determining what was at the back of all this noise, activity, which he could detect as being what the public thought. And I think there are some other things to say about this, the view of society. It is, we're talking about a political judgment, a political level of discourse, I said. And that's why I put in two bits of quote from Isaiah Berlin, Two Concepts of Liberty. The first saying that where the objectives are agreed, the only questions left are those of means, and these are not political but technical. That is to say, capable of being settled by experts or machines, no less, like arguments between engineers or doctors, or I'm inclined to say about lawyers, because the Dworkin approach is legalistic, and I think there is a distinction between that kind of, it's rather rude to say technical, but objectively resolvable discussion, and political, where there are conflicts of ends, where objectives are having to be balanced and weighed up against each other. And that is the general theme, or equally, of Isaiah Berlin, that the world we encounter in ordinary experience is one in which we are faced with choice between ends equally ultimate and claims equally absolute, the realisation of some of which must inevitably involve the sacrifice of others. And that, I think, is a very wise proviso to keep in view, that you are always balancing, organising compromises between conflicting objectives. I found another quote by an extreme Islamist in somewhere in the Middle East, I can't remember exactly where, who said rather concisely, democracy is polytheism. And it seems to me that is spot on, that democracy is about all those objectives I've been talking about. And he hated it, of course, because his alternative view of the role of the state is presumably that Sharia law and Islamist fundamentalist governments had one single objective, which is to fulfill the will of God as interpreted by the clerical authorities. So that is monotheism. Democracy is quite the opposite. And the problem, as I've been saying, of discovering what in practice this nebulous view of society may amount to was, well, it's very familiar, and we all know how far from deep democracy Hans' idea it actually is. And I'm hazy about how we would ever get to anywhere near deep democracy and tell it the difference of it from anarchy. But perhaps in some ideal world we could, and perhaps we should aim at the ideal. But I'm looking at the practicalities, and you'll remember Rousseau saying the English nation thinks it's free, but it's greatly mistaken, for it is only during the election of members of Parliament, as soon as they're elected, it is enslaved and counts for nothing. Very French, very thin, logical, completely wrong, in the sense that, you know, my experience of politicians, having watched them from fairly close to, is that they're intensely sensitive to what the latest puff of wind, the latest press headline happens to be that day. So I don't actually agree that Rousseau has but you can see what he's getting at. There is a limit to representative democracy as a detecting and determining view of society. And I don't think you can defend democracy as I say, by any means perfect. Indeed, the Popper definition we had this morning, that democracy is simply a system allowing for change without bloodshed, is much nearer the truth than the essential value, it seems to me, of democracy as a representative democracy, as a way of getting to this ideal objective I've been discussing. The third heading I wanted to touch on briefly, it is in my formula the most difficult in a sense, those services which are worth providing, because it immediately implies that there are going to be, in deciding whether a service is worth providing, there are going to be costs as well as benefits. That's the nature of things. and weighing those against each other will, precisely because of the Berlin point, there are a lot of conflicting objectives, be a matter of comparing indeterminates and a political judgment. In fact, that was the Robert Peel point, that this is a job for politicians to detect, and if they get it wrong, then they're more likely to be out. And democracy is, therefore, a system for implying weights for pointing to the evaluation of relative costs and benefits. But these will change and shift, and that's why I put in also under worth providing the qualification about efficiency in the market. Whatever the Marxists say, the competition, nasty as it may look in broad principle, does actually test to an extent whether the service is being provided as well as cheaply as at as low cost as it can be, and that view of the market as not guaranteeing but promoting efficiency, except where there are detectable inefficiencies, comes from Adam Smith again, and is quite a good starting point for this kind of evaluation of state intervention, because state intervention doesn't have this kind of natural corrective. It does imply bureaucracy because of accountability, and there are ways of diminishing it, the sort of PFIs that Anne hates, where you get a bit of competition in at the margin, but because the objectives are variable and shifting, as I've been saying, you get a contractual arrangement so that it can be handed over to the private sector, and then things turn out differently and the risks haven't been properly transferred. It's not a remedy, and here I go to all possible ways of ensuring state efficiency. So given that there are these counter-arguments against state provisional services, it's always going to be a balance, and businessmen coming into government are always saying it's the worst, most inefficient system known to man, completely failing to understand it. But it's there, and in a mixed economy it goes on being there, and I think we have to examine it in this kind of context. And so I've set up this tripartite model, and I will just skip briefly to what I see as its advantages. It does provide, I mean, it may not answer the question why should I obey the state or rebel against it, but it does provide a framework, any more than Locke answered in practice about when you should rebel or obey. He just set up a framework for answering that kind of question, and I think this is a framework for answering the real questions that we do see ourselves facing about BBC or post office or all the things at the margin current role of the state. But it's also, I put less adversarial, it doesn't assume that there is a zero sum, you win, we lose, but it does suggest that each of the three individual state and market have a role. And that for the state to provide services is not necessarily or equivalently to infringe the liberties of individuals. The classic example we haven't had, I think, is driving left on the roads. No worthwhile liberty is lost by the state decreeing that you drive on the left, or it might be the right, but preferably not both. And that is the kind of thing that so it's not a zero sum, and I think it much more obviously than that. Market imperfections and a great many other things can be, correction of poverty is the biggest that I've referred to very briefly. So that this is meant to be neutral as between minimalist and quite extensive sort of Scandinavian maximalist views of what the state can and should do. But I hope it provides an interesting framework for discussion anyway.